Goldie Sayers, Olympic medalist and former javelin thrower. And you're listening to the EIS Insider, the podcast from the English Institute of Sport that lifts the lid on the science behind peak performance. So far this series, we've explored how to eat, sleep and train like an athlete. All important aspects of the physical. But in today's episode, we're going to be discussing our mental health. Perhaps for too long, an aspect of elite sport that didn't gain enough attention. But with many high-profile athletes choosing to speak out about their own mental health, that conversation is beginning to change. During this episode, we're going to be finding out about the idea of performance decompression, a process implemented by the EIS in their work with athletes and staff who've come back from major competition, such as Tokyo 2020. Stay tuned for that discussion. But first, I want to introduce you to my guests who both work at the forefront of mental health and psychology in sport. I'm joined by the EIS's Sam Cumming. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Goldie.
And Sarah Cecil. Hello, Sarah.
Hey, Goldie.
So, Sam, tell us what it is that you do at the EIS.
So I'm the acting head of mental health at the EIS, which means I'm responsible for helping make sure the system is promoting and supporting mental health for all the people they're involved in the system. So it's quite a wide-ranging role, but in practice it means delivering mental health education and training for sports, and then right the way through to making sure that we've got the best quality support for athletes when they need that extra bit of support, maybe for an external referral or something like that, and all sorts of other things in between.
Oh, fantastic. And Sarah, same to you. So what do you do on a day-to-day basis for the EIS?
Yeah, so I sort of do three roles for the EIS. I'm the sports psychologist for the wheelchair tennis team for GB Snow Sport. And then I'm a technical lead, which involves supporting other sports psychologists. And more recently, my role has been much more involved in supporting the whole system around what we can take from performance psychology into everyone's practice.
Fantastic. And how do the EIS work with athletes on this sort of psychosocial level? And you talk about support. So what support does that look like in practical terms?
Yes. So the sort of traditional sports psychology or performance psychology that you would have been familiar with, Goldie. We've got performance lifestyle, who we work much more closely with. And then we've got the mental health expert team. So if you imagine there's a continuum from the mental health expert team to the sports psychologists, the performance lifestyle advisors, and we're trying to provide like a cohesive service around all three and support athlete and staff in these areas.
Recently, we've heard a lot about athlete mental health in the media with tennis star Naomi Osaka and cricketer Ben Stokes. They've all taken time away from their sport for mental health reasons. Is it something that's increased or are we talking about it more now?
It's certainly something that we're talking about more. So people have always had mental health in the same way they've got physical health. And I guess what's changed is we've really started to recognise how important a role we can play in supporting mental health, particularly in high performance sport. So a lot of the work that's been done in promoting positive mental health and supporting mental health has predated even the last 4 years when, as a system, we've come together and supported mental health a lot more. So an example of that would be 2015, where mental health conditions were brought into the sort of suite of things that you could get support for as part of your athlete medical insurance. So that was a huge change to be able to get access to mental health support in the same way as you would do for an ACL injury or a shoulder injury. And we've gradually seen changes through the system ever since then. So our EIS mental health team being put together in late 2018 was, I guess, the start of that really being provided as a central service by the EIS to support sports in developing mental health. But there have been people in sports like Sarah who've been interested in and, you know, passionate about supporting mental health from way before any of those sort of formal changes were made. So I guess it would be unfair to say it's all just sort of kicked off in this last year. There's been a very gradual, slow build. I think it's probably reflecting a wider change in society that we've seen as well, where people just generally are more open and willing to talk about mental health.
And do you think sometimes athletes are reluctant to ask for help, or are they getting a bit better at seeking out support?
I think we're seeing a change there too. So I think certainly that was the case. And you could understand why, in a similar way to seeking help for physical health, you know, do you want to admit that you've got an injury at the moment because you're just coming into this period of selection? And maybe that's sort of how it played out with mental health. And I think that's still there to an extent. There's still that stigma with mental health in the same way as there is still that stigma in wider society. We're definitely seeing a change in the number of people coming forward. And I think we're also seeing a change in how early people are coming forward and seeking support. So we've noticed that certainly that people are that bit more willing, certainly athletes are that bit more willing to come forward a little earlier to seek the appropriate support so we can put that in place. And people are putting their hands up to say, I need some support a bit earlier than they would do previously.
And around COVID and lockdowns, were athletes seeking out support much more frequently? Because I can imagine, obviously, their day-to-day lives were changed completely.
We just had much more regular check-ins with everybody. And what we understood around each athlete was who were the best person was to check in with them. And it okay. might be the physio, it might be the S&C coach. So we've educated everybody to be able to have a conversation around mental health. So we've educated people to know what questions to ask and know how to signpost.
So what is a good question to ask if you think or suspect that somebody is struggling a bit?
I think you ask them, how are you doing?
Okay.
Do you want to talk to me about what you're experiencing, how long it's been going on for? You know, that there are options of help out there, that talking about it doesn't make it worse. That's a big thing we've got across the system.
Yeah, absolutely. That first question sometimes feels like the hardest one to ask. And the way we've put it in our mental health awareness workshop is that usually there's something you've seen that's made you concerned about someone. And so that can be a really helpful way to start that conversation. I've noticed that you've been looking a bit more withdrawn in the last few times we've caught up. Is everything okay? So you've sort of shown that person that they've been seen, you've recognised. And the worst that can happen is they say, no, I'm absolutely fine. Don't know where you got that from. But actually the benefits of starting to answer those questions and asking that, are you okay? And asking that twice is a really good one as well. Just to, are you really okay? Is a sort of good examples of that.
Asking about, you know, how someone is it, are you asking the exact same questions for an elite athlete as you are to somebody in the general public?
Yeah, it's exactly the same questions. How are you doing? You seem a bit different than normal. Are you okay? And then are you okay again?
And you're obviously working with a lot of, you know, elite athletes. How much does their mental health really impact their performance?
It definitely impacts their performance. The way I look at mental health as it relates to high performance is it's a bit of a foundation for building long-term sustainable high performance. So you can definitely perform with your mental health not in its best place. And you can definitely have really good mental health and not perform well. So it's not the be all and end all for your performance. But what I think a good foundation of solid mental health does is provide a foundation for long-term performance. So we know that people can naturally are going to struggle through their athletic career. There's going to be periods when you have the dips, just like everyone else would have dips in how their mental health is doing. But the ability to have that strong foundation of solid mental health is going to make a bigger difference longer term, I think.
Yeah, because I was going to ask you that. Have you seen athletes who are at a kind of low ebb mentally and maybe emotionally, but who are able to perform, you know, to the highest level? Is that a regular occurrence or is that a bit of an anomaly?
Well, it's definitely possible. And if you look at the sort of unique stresses that our athletes are under, it's probably natural that we'd probably not be feeling always in the best place mentally all the way through the year, and certainly as we come to the game. So the main thing I think is about how do you achieve that balance of knowing there's going to be periods when you are struggling mentally. How do you know when who your sources of support are that you'd go to reach out for that help and support? How do you know where you're going to find that balance to even that out and have some time to recover? So yeah, I guess to answer the question, you certainly do see it, but that's why it's so important that we're so open and clear about what support's available, how people can reach out and support, and why it's so important that we hear how normal it is for athletes to experience those things, as we've seen with the examples that have been more prominent in the media.
Yeah, and you talk there about the pressures that athletes are under. Sarah, what sorts of pressures? You've dealt with a lot of elite athletes over many, many years. What pressures are there internally and externally that they usually experience inside and outside of competition?
Yeah, so the internal ones are their own expectations. That's the reality of elite sport. You get judged very quickly in elite sport on your performance. It's a very public judgment. There's comparison to others. There's a lot of the sort of you don't necessarily go through the natural stages of life that other people do, where in terms of making friends, you know, people go to university and make friends, they go to work and make friends. So sometimes the social support around elite athletes is smaller than for the general public. The fact that your performance determines your funding. So there's a variety of elements. There's been away from home a lot. So if you think about the numbers of days people are away from home, that's another stressor. So there's stresses in any walk of life, and these are the specific stressors which create pressure for elite athletes.
I'm really fascinated by some work that you've been recently involved with, Sarah, this idea of decompression in sport and how important that is, especially after Tokyo 2020 with this shortened Olympic cycle into Paris 2024. So tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so the EIS performance psychology team have created a 4-stage process called performance decompression, which incorporates 2 stages which would have traditionally been used a lot anyway. So if you imagine, Goldie, you competed in Tokyo, you do your normal hot debrief while you're still on Japanese soil with your support team around you. And then what we're really interested in, what you do when your season comes to an end. So traditionally, people would do a hot debrief, have a holiday, and then come back into the environment and do a performance debrief. We feel there were 2 stages which were missing. And we've learned a lot of this from lessons we've learned in lockdown about returning to the workplace. So what we've done is we've suggested that there's a stage called time zero, and there's another stage called process the emotion. Time zero is what you do when you take your break at the end of your season. And if we imagine that would be roughly 2 weeks, and we'd give some recommendations about what you do in that time around staying in the present, riding the wave of emotions which will come, and connecting with friends and family. And the aim is to meet some of your basic human needs and manage a bit of restorative care. So that's the new stage we've kind of introduced, which some people might have done anyway, but we just want to ensure it occurs across the system for athletes and staff. And then the next stage, we've coined it process the emotion. And what we're interested in there is that both athletes and staff process the emotion that surrounds performance. So it's a 6-stage process where you have an emotionally driven conversation where you're interested in exploring meaningful moments that occurred for you as an individual during your games period. Exploring what they were, understanding the emotion which sits behind them, and then starting to understand how you coped. So what were your strengths that you utilized? What were your skills? So if you imagine it's a 6-stage process, which by the end of you're thinking, okay, I've acknowledged my emotions, I've spent time with them, I've named them. I've also understood how I managed and how I coped. And that thing starts to give you an insight in what you can take into next, whatever your next steps are going to be. So whatever you want to take forward from that. So if you imagine it, we want people to go through this process so that the emotion isn't ignored.
Okay. And have you found any issues with athletes actually being able to identify those emotions, given that I think most athletes spend their entire lives trying to be emotionless because it kind of helps performance in some ways? Is that, you know, I guess a stage before that, is there any help on offer in terms of to identify the actual emotion that they perhaps experienced?
We would show them things like an emotional wheel where there are different emotions on it, which so they could pick ones which would represent how they feel. What we were helping people to do is to name their emotion. And also, if you are doing this stage with them, you can name what you see as a guest. So you might say, okay, Goldie, I see this in you. Is that an accurate representation of the emotion? And this work is built on the work we did in lockdown. So people are much more familiar in this space now, we think.
Okay. And am I right that some of this research has been developed through borrowing some research from hostage situations?
Yes. So when we realised people were going to return to work post-lockdown, we thought, right, we've got to find some way to help this transition. So we looked to see what hostages did on their return home. And so we looked at the research done by the Red Cross on this.
Okay.
We trained people up in a lockdown debrief process as people came out of lockdown and back into the workplace. We also looked at what the military do post going on tour. And so this has informed a lot of our thinking. So we've got all the sort of how do you do a good debrief as a sports psychologist, bringing emotion in. We've looked at what the what hostage survivors did. And a lot of that is around peer support.
Okay.
Our aim is to train the staff up to look after each other as well as the athletes.
So what are the similarities between perhaps going to Tokyo 2020 or an Olympic Games and having experience being a hostage?
So I think it's probably the heightened pressure, the heightened emotion, the sense of urgency. And especially we're thinking of Tokyo with all the COVID restrictions, where people have been restricted in what they did. So it was really true as people came out of lockdown, and we thought there'd be a carryover in that sense. And the main aim about this is that you have to process the emotion. And it's best often to do it with your peers in that sense. That's another sort of lesson we've learned from that.
Okay. And Sam, is this something that you've seen with some of the athletes that you've worked with? You know, what sorts of things can they be feeling or experiencing at the end of an Olympic cycle?
One of the bits that really resonated with me with what Sarah said there is that idea of change and transition, and that's really significant. And the athlete experience is probably quite a series of transitions, but a really big one is the end of the Olympic or Paralympic cycle is a huge transition. And so that was something that we've certainly recognised, and we've again similarly borrowed from somewhere a bit different to try and inform our thinking on this. So thinking of things like the research on loss and adjustment to how you adjust to and cope with loss can be quite a helpful way of thinking about how we apply our thinking to a big change or transition, like coming to the end of your career, or like Sarah said, coming out of lockdown or coming back from the games. It's all obviously interrelated with the work that the guys in the psych team are doing. But so we've looked at how you have some of those models that help you understand loss to help us understand how we might process some of those emotions, or certainly at least accept that we're going to experience some of those emotions. So the point Sarah said about riding the wave has been a really helpful analogy for people recognizing, actually, I'm going to get some of these emotions, and it's important to experience them, recognize them, and then move on to the next one. So yeah, we often think about loss as experiencing things, some combination of that classic denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and then acceptance, and bouncing between those in a bit of a random order until we end up at acceptance. Those are the typical emotions we might see, but obviously, as we all know, everyone's different, so everyone will experience them at different intensities and times, and spend different periods in each of those emotions.
Okay. And Sarah, with your sort of psychologist's hat on, if somebody has had a disastrous games and there's a lot of negative emotions swirling around in their head, how do you turn a negative emotion into a positive one when, you know, the end of the games come?
Actually, we spend quite a bit of time with the negative emotion. So we'll spend some time there understanding it, that actually acknowledge that this may have been a really difficult time. There may be a sense of loss. So actually, we'd spend a bit more time with it than you might imagine. And then you'd try and understand why they chose to go to the games and what's their bigger picture, what are their values underlying the journey they've chosen to go on. And then start to move into, okay, so what's next for you? But you would probably spend a fair bit of time understanding exactly what that experience was and the negative emotions that they've experienced and acknowledge them.
And then once you've acknowledged that sort of negative emotion, what do you do with it then?
You need to understand, they need to be really clear why they're choosing, if they're choosing to continue the journey. And then they need to really make sense of their performance and understand what happened. And then through reflection and learning, understand what happened and why it happened. And either that then gives them a sense that this may be time to stop and the closure, or I'm going to carry on and do things maybe a bit differently. But you really want to spend a long time in the emotion and then start to say, okay, right, what's next? What meaning have you taken from that experience? What would you do differently? What may you want to change?
I remember vividly coming back from, or not coming back because we were already in London and I was living in London at the time, just coming back from the Olympic Park, back to the training centre, collecting my car from where I trained every day for 4 years and putting my bags back in the car, getting back to my flat and sitting on the sofa and just thinking, wow, well, that was that was that. What do I do now? And I was like, well, I guess you have to just make a cup of tea. And it, the very, very strange situation of almost feeling like you've kind of come out of the Big Brother house in many ways and kind of burst this bubble that the Olympics inevitably is, and back into normal life. Is there a difference, do you think, between different games? Or do you just see that, you know, every Olympic Games? Was London a bit bigger in terms of the come down, or is that just in my imagination?
Well, I think London was odd for a lot of us because I got the tube home at the end of it as well. You know, so the natural transition of getting on a flight, pack, you know, was missing for lots of people. So that's why we're saying do this time zero. So now, Goldie, I'd be saying, okay, so what is your season finishing? What's your plan? Let's look at what you do in the 2 weeks post the games. Let's have this conversation about processing the emotion 3-4 weeks post the games. And we didn't do that as well back then for lots of different reasons. And acknowledging you may experience, it may be very normal to experience some low mood post the games, but it's more important that we make sure you have some things planned, as opposed to coming back going, all right, make a cup of tea and what next? So one of the big elements of the decompression piece is that people then start to set some goals around what they're going to do next, which we know is an important part of then moving you on to whatever you're going to do next.
Yeah, there were definitely some parties planned, that for sure.
Yeah.
beyond that, and actually an operation, sadly, in my case. But could you apply some of this work to everyday life, and perhaps if we liken it to coming out of the COVID situation when people are kind of reappearing into the sunlight and reintegrating in society, what would you say to everybody who's kind of readjusting to this kind of post-COVID world?
It's important they talk to people who were providing them support about what it was like for them and share the emotions of what they experienced. And you may want to share it with quite a few people. So, you know, you could do a timeline of your lockdown experience and were there critical moments and what emotions did you experience? And then more importantly, how did you cope? Because people have coped and they would have found strengths and skills that they weren't aware of. And how can you then utilise these strengths and skills going forward with whatever you choose to do next?
It's important to recognise that it's completely normal to experience negative emotions, whether you've performed in the way you hadn't hoped to at the Olympic or Paralympic Games, or whether you're adjusting to going back into the office 5 days a week. It's normal to experience a range of emotions, and they'll be different for individual people. So the emotions you're experiencing might be very different to the emotions that your partner's experiencing in a similar experience of adjustment. So I guess the key point is to just accept a bit of that and normalize a bit of that range of emotions that are experienced. So that's a really key point for me. And that sense, again, of riding the wave of the emotions is really important. That analogy is a really helpful one to make us realize actually we don't have to just be focusing on just trying to be experiencing good emotions all the time. It's normal for us to experience some of those negative ones. But also importantly, know where your line might be. How long is too long to be spending in that negative emotion? And as you get to the point, you think, actually, this is really unhelpful and I'm not getting anywhere with this, then where is your additional levels of support and help beyond what you might get from speaking to a friend or someone about that? So for people in the general public, that could be anything from third sector charity organisations, helplines, GP, IAPT, all sorts of different places.
So right now we should all kind of think of ourselves as surfers and riding a kind of imaginary wave.
Definitely, I like that idea. Actually, we're all different. We're all surfers on the different waves.
And at what point should people ask for help with their mental health?
There's a few ways of looking at it. So one is you could take the sort of hard and fast definition of a mental health problem, which is something that's affected you negatively, which you can't alleviate with your normal coping strategies for sort of 2 weeks or more. Obviously, mental health is a grey and quite messy area. So it's difficult to just say, if you've been feeling like this for 2 exact weeks, you need to go and see this person. So I guess that's why I made the point about knowing where your line is, realising where actually this for me feels like it's been too uncomfortable for too long, or it's been, I've been feeling in a way that I'm not happy with for too long. But again, that can be another area where the people that we know and are closest to can be really helpful allies in talking to them about, actually, I've been feeling like this for a while, or they might reflect back to you that you haven't seemed like yourself and have you thought about getting support. So it's difficult to give you a hard and fast rule, but typically sort of the 2 week period of experiencing something is what's sort of put out there in the literature. But then depending on the context, depends on how you might change. If you've, you know, lost a significant loved one, then feeling down for 2 weeks is completely normal. So yeah, it's quite individual, but that's why, again, it's so important to have that reflection time and to know yourself and what's normal for you.
And obviously, you know, reaching out to somebody, but beyond that, what would you recommend people do in terms of asking for help? What's the next step? Is it GP or?
Outside of sport, yeah, absolutely. GP is a great source of support. There's an NHS-supported programme called IAPT, which is Improving Access to Psychological Therapies. That's like an online referral, self-referral tool. So it's still done through the NHS. It's done based on which NHS trust you're in. But that can get you access to mental health support that's maybe slightly quicker than getting an appointment with the GP, seeing the doctor, taking the referral. So, and the services they offer are a range of different things, but they're often cognitive behavioural therapy online courses, which can be really helpful. But what's also really good is looking at things like the Mind website, reading up about and understanding what sort of things you're experiencing. If you've got something to do with bereavement, for example, there's bereavement charities that you can read up and get some tips as well and support, in addition to talking to the people that are around you and who know you.
Sam, Sarah, it sounds like the great work you're doing is going to be hugely beneficial and perhaps rolled out more prevalently, which is fantastic, as I'm sure a lot more athletes are going to be helped. So thank you. So that's it. That's the last episode in this series. Thanks so much to everyone who's taken the time to listen and to send in messages about the show. Just like Dave in California, who says he stumbled across this podcast and was thrilled to find advice on so many aspects of sporting life that's not only great for athletes, but has been good for him as well. If you've missed any of our previous episodes, don't forget to check them out for free wherever you get your podcasts. And if, like Dave, you found this series useful and would like to hear more from the EIS, then let us know. Find us on social media at EIS to win. And don't forget to check out our website and YouTube channel for more great content from the English Institute of Sport. Thanks to everyone behind the scenes who helped with this podcast, to John, Tash, Grace and Chessie, and to all the EIS experts who gave up their time to talk to us. But most of all, thanks to you for listening. And let's catch up soon.